The Arthropod. The Arthropod is the home for the wonderful, weird, wacky world of insects. Hosted by Jonathan Larson, Jody Green, and Michael Scavarla.
Welcome back to Arthropod, your entomology podcast. I am one of your hosts for the day, Jonathan Larson of the University of Kentucky.
I'm another one of your hosts. I'm Jody Green from the University of Nebraska-Lincoln.
And we are joined by a very special guest. Very special guest, would you mind introducing yourselves to the Arthropod listeners?
Hey, listeners. My name is Andrew Sutherland. I'm coming to you from the University of California. I'm currently sitting in my office in Hayward, California, which is on the east side of San Francisco Bay.
That's awesome. Are you psyched for the upcoming big football game?
Yeah, you know, a lot of my friends are San Francisco 49ers fans. I like the strategy of the game, but I'm not a fan of that particular team. So my role is to interject just enough NFL knowledge to make my friends nervous.
Okay.
And then, elevate the stress so that it's more fun for everyone. And okay. Then at the end of the game, no matter the outcome, high five or hug them.
Right. So you win no matter what. And yes, you get to inject cortisol into the situation. I love it. This is a great strategy. Unfortunately, we're not here to talk about the NFL, as entertaining as that might be. We have Dr. Sutherland on to talk with us about Turkestan roaches, as well as his role as an IPM advisor out in the UC system and urban entomology in general. We're very excited.
Do you want to talk about your role out there? Because I think it's really cool. I've run into Andrew many times, but not lately, at different conferences, urban entomology and IPM symposium, I believe. You've always got the coolest booths with the most interactive, educational, fun stuff. Wasn't there a board all about poop? And then there's one all about wood-destroying insects. And I think you told me I was one of the only people that got it all right that one time.
Yeah, I think that was Pest World 2019 in San Diego. You were the only one who successfully identified all of the wood specimens. You identified the wood-destroying organism that had caused the damage in those specimens. So that I was impressed. You've always impressed me, Jody. I'm glad that we're doing this here today. I'm an urban entomologist. I work as an urban IPM advisor for UC Cooperative Extension. And I'm also associated with the statewide IPM program, better known as UCIPM, which, believe it or not, is the most widely accessed source of pest management information in the world.
I would believe it based on some of the stuff that I've read through your system. That absolutely tracks for me.
You've got like the greatest posters, and I mean, you have a huge reach. Your stuff is so good.
Well, we try, and we, you know, try to get educational messages out using different formats, different reading levels and styles, or I should say writing styles. But yeah, that's what it's all about. It's extension. Mm-hmm. So we're in the business of information and extending evidence-based information, you know, hopefully to make a difference in the lives of our clients. So in my case, I work with pest management professionals. These are all the people that are managing pests as part of their job. They may be part of the pest control industry. They may work for municipalities or government agency, school districts, housing districts. And so I actually learn a lot from them. They're out there in the trenches battling key urban pests, not all of which are insects. You know, I'm learning about four-legged furries as well. But yeah, I learned from them and hopefully can design some applied research programs that answer their questions, address their needs, and it's a continuous relationship. It's a lot of fun, and I don't get bored.
Yeah, nobody in extension ever gets bored, I would argue. This may be a bit elementary, perhaps, but we have agents here. We have extension agents in Kentucky Nebraska has extension educators. You're an extension advisor. Are there a lot of differences between these roles? We have some folks that listen to the show that are kind of interested in extension as a career. If they were looking at these job titles, what kind of comparisons and contrasts would there be between them?
So you'd have to go back in the history of the University of California. It has to do in how they've decided to carry out the land grant mission. So I'm an advisor, cooperative extension advisor, and I think in other states, my role may typically be called an agent. So I'm embedded in a community rather than on campus. People often ask me, what campus do you work on? And it's either none of them or all of them, could both be correct, but I'm actually embedded in a series of county partnerships. I'm based out of Alameda County, and we're hosted here by the Department of Agriculture, but then I also operate in four other counties. And so that's the traditional kind of extension agent role, where I'm embedded in my client community. I hear from them, I work with them, I collaborate with them. But in California, the cooperative extension advisors have traditionally carried out more applied research than cooperative extension agents may in other states. We don't require PhD for our cooperative extension advisors, but I would say certainly in the past couple of decades, the majority of us who have been hired do have PhDs and research experience. So yeah, I know that the agents in a lot of states, their job is to extend information. They don't necessarily run their own research program. In California, we do both.
So do you have students and write grants to support your program?
If I want to hire anyone, I need to secure extramural funds. So that could be grants, contracts, but I'm not part of the academic senate, so I can't technically train graduate students. So we do get students, but they're usually hired on as lab assistants. Sometimes if we don't have funding, we'll take interns, and hopefully that becomes a funded position. But no, I don't train graduate students like campus-based colleagues.
Yeah, you mentioned not being on campus. I noticed on your webpage that you serve Alameda, Contra Costa, I apologize if my Kentucky is showing, San Francisco, San Mateo, and Santa Clara counties. What's the estimated population there? Like, what is your...
It's about 8 million people.
Yeah, okay. That's a lot of people for one extension agent.
Yeah. Well, so my colleague down in Southern California has, I think, three counties, one of which is LA, you know, Los Angeles County, which has 10 million people just in one county. So, you know, 8 million, I'm getting off pretty easy.
Pretty light, yeah.
I don't serve the general public, you know, so I serve professionals, and hopefully they extend information and resources to the public. We work with a lot of extender groups like the Master Gardeners and others who do interface with the residential public.
It all sounds very familiar. It's very good for me to hear all this, because it makes it sound like there is a continuous system across the country. I was kind of curious about your background. How did you get into things that get into people's houses, urban entomology? I see a terrifying rat poster behind you.
Yeah.
Was that a dream of yours to fight rats and cockroaches as a child? Or?
I think all things nature and ecology. You know, I grew up in Central Florida catching snakes and lizards. I had the kind of childhood where we were outside, and as long as we were home by dinner, there were no questions asked. So we would definitely, you know, wrestle with small alligators and venomous snakes. And at one point, I raised a colony of lubber grasshoppers. It's like a short-horned accreted grasshopper. So I had a colony of those. I had a kiddie pool that I turned into a pond. And then I had to deal with raccoons that were eating my toads. So I have a childhood full of, you know, just kind of dabbling in different ecosystems. I was in horticultural and agricultural entomology, IPM, as a grad student and a postdoc. And when you graduate in 2009, so I got my PhD in 2009, during a global recession, there really weren't a lot of opportunities. And so when I was a postdoctoral researcher, I was looking for anything that may be any kind of a fit, you know. And so this urban IPM extension job came available. It didn't require relocation over a long distance. And they gave me the job, even though I didn't have any practical experience with urban systems at that time. I had a good command of the holistic IPM principles that could be applied to lots of different pests, basically any pest. And I demonstrated that during the interview. I got the job. And now I've completely turned my back on agriculture and plant systems, and I've completely embraced urban and human-based community systems. Very rewarding. So when I was in agriculture, I might tell people about my project, you know, working with, you know, in one case, I was working with a coccinella beetle that ate powdery mildew spores on, you know, grapes and other crops. I was working with aphid vectors of viruses. And so you talk about that and people's eyes kind of gloss over, you know, unless they're in agriculture or even in your agricultural system. But in urban systems, I'm working with bed bugs and cockroaches and termites and ants and wasps. And people want to talk about that. You know, you'll be the most popular person at the cocktail party. And so I've really enjoyed that aspect of it, being able to help friends and family. And then the cool thing is that urban pests are found all over the world. Anywhere that we have human communities, you find the same kinds of critters. So I can really extend knowledge all over the place.
I always say I work and love the things that you love to hate. Today, we're actually going to talk about one of those urban pests. We're going to talk about cockroaches and a specific cockroach called the Turkestan cockroach, which I don't know how it came up in conversation, but Jonathan was like, hey, have you ever heard of this cockroach? We should talk about it. And I'm like, I know the perfect person.
I am on a couple of committees for one of our faculty here who's our urban entomologist, Zach DeVries. I don't know if you've met Zach before. One of his new students asked me to be on his PhD committee, and he kind of had this addendum to his committee meeting that we just had a few weeks ago or a month ago, and he sort of went through all this stuff. And at the end, he's like, oh, by the way, I want to look at Turkestan roaches, because he'd met somebody, I think from Arkansas, that was doing some interesting stuff with them kind of in Tennessee or near Tennessee. And he wanted to go down and join up and like add some Kentucky knowledge to the mix. And I'd never heard of it. The more he talked about it, the more I was like, this seems like a cockroach that needs a podcast episode about it. And so I asked Jody if she was willing to put something together. And yeah, she immediately said, I know exactly who to contact. So how do you feel about being the Turkestan roach guy?
I'm fine with it. somebody's got to do it. So I think there are lots of opportunities for people to work with Turkestan cockroaches now because they're so widespread. They also have changed the game for kind of outdoor peridomestic cockroach management in the West, maybe in parts of the South. So a lot of people are paying attention. You know, I can only share, you know, my experiences from my research projects. But Turkestan cockroaches have been here for decades. For some reason, they're becoming really pestiferous in the past decade or so. And then, of course, spreading across the United States and popping up on people's radars. I think they're pretty interesting. As charismatic as a cockroach can be.
Whereabouts are they located right now? I'm in Nebraska. I've not seen any. Where are they? Where are they common? And where are they getting to be super popular?
Yeah. It's unclear exactly what the distribution looks like right now. What I can say is that Turkestan cockroaches appear to be the most common outdoor peridomestic species in the Southwest United States. So that includes most of California, all of New Mexico, Arizona, Utah, Nevada, parts of western Texas. And then, as Jonathan mentioned, kind of moving into parts of the South, including Arkansas, Tennessee. I've heard reports from parts of Georgia. And yeah, so it's unclear. On the West Coast, I've heard reports from eastern Oregon, eastern Washington, kind of the more arid parts of the Pacific Northwest. It's unclear, you know, if there is a cold weather factor that may inhibit spread northward. They may be outcompeted by other outdoor species in humid areas, but they tend to do very well in warm, arid areas. So, and what they've done basically is, in the West, displace oriental cockroaches. So I wonder, in Nebraska, do you have oriental cockroaches living outside?
Yes, we do. Mm-hmm.
So these are closely related. They may have similar cold tolerances. It's conceivable that they may replace oriental cockroaches wherever they exist for several reasons.
Or maybe they have. Maybe I need to go find some.
Yeah. And, like, and they can be easily mistaken, you know. So a lot of people will confuse Turkestan cockroaches for oriental cockroaches, especially, you know, the females are almost identical when you're just looking at kind of the overall morphology. So I think there are cases where people have had this species for a while, but they think they're dealing with oriental cockroaches, and they're wondering, why are there more than usual? Why are these oriental cockroaches behaving differently than they have in the past?
Do you want to talk about how oriental cockroaches usually behave? I think here people call them water bugs,
yeah,
because they're associated with that high moisture. I'm always thinking like laundry rooms and basement, like subfloors.
Yeah,
low
they're
ground.
Highly reliant on moisture protected environments. So with oriental cockroaches, historically, at least in California, we've seen them in places like water meter boxes, irrigation valve boxes, spaces underneath poured concrete, other voids within hardscape, brick walls, rock walls, firewood piles. So those are the areas that they're hiding during the day. And then at night, they're foraging around for decaying matter, you know, which could be of plant or animal origin. And then when they find their way inside, usually it's because your structure is not well sealed, whether that's exterior doors with a gap underneath or foundation damage or perhaps drain damage, you know, so drains that lead to the sewer can also provide access for these cockroaches. So Turkestan cockroaches live in all of those same places. In some areas of the country and world, they will also colonize the sanitary sewer. I think that is less common in the United States, because we have American cockroaches in the sanitary sewers, and they tend to be more aggressive, they're larger, and they don't coexist. You know, they roaches are cannibalistic and will attack one another.
So where you found the Turkestan cockroaches, they've displaced the oriental roaches, so they do not live together.
There are some sites that are kind of on, you could say, the front of the wave of Turkestan movement where you can find both. But if you visit those sites over time, you will find less and less oriental cockroaches until some point you don't find any oriental cockroaches. I was reading a paper in preparation for this, and it's a great paper that you guys should check out. It's by Tina Kim and Mike Rust, published in 2013, about Turkestan cockroaches. And it was noting that in some school districts in Los Angeles, they were doing surveys of the irrigation valve boxes, and they would find one or the other. So this site had both species, but they would never find both species together. They would find either Oriental or Turkestan. And then, of course, if you go back to those sites now, there's only Turkestan cockroaches.
Wow.
They won the war.
Yeah. They produce a lot more offspring, is one reason. So cockroaches produce eggs within oophagy, these kind of, you know, egg capsules. And so the Turkestan cockroach, at least in a lab environment, they recorded them to produce something like up to 25 oophagy per female. I mean, that's on the extreme end, but the oriental cockroach, you're talking about, you know, less than 10 during their lifetime. So, you know, you're talking 2 to 3 times more egg production over the life of the adult female.
A classic invasive species attribute, if there ever was one, reproductive capabilities.
Yeah. Another really important factor, which may be driving displacement, is the Turkestan cockroach appears to be more adapted to arid environments. So researchers have actually measured decreased water loss through the cuticle as compared to the oriental cockroach. So in an arid environment, it's better able to survive and maintain its moisture levels. And so actually, this is kind of just observational, but we had a 3-year drought in California. I think it was 2014 through 2016. And after that period was when we saw an explosion of Turkestan cockroach in my area, in the San Francisco Bay Area and the Central Valley. So it may be that during the drought, the oriental cockroaches didn't do so well and the Turkestans were able to kind of move in and take hold.
Do they really come from Turkey?
They may be found, especially in eastern Turkey. Turkestan cockroaches are thought to be native to a pretty wide area, all the way from North Africa, east into Central Asia. So they've been recorded from Libya, east to Pakistan, you know, north into Iran, and definitely parts of eastern Turkey. So yeah, with a lot of cockroaches, it's difficult to know exactly where they may be native to because they move around so well with humans. And that's actually how we think Turkestan cockroaches arrived in the U.S. is moving with human, in this case, equipment from military installments in Western Asia back to the United States.
So it was first found in an armed forces base here in this country, or first confirmed, I should say.
Yeah, the first record is 1978, I think, and that's from an Army depot in Lathrop, California, which is only about an hour and a half east of where I'm sitting right now. It's just south of Stockton in the Central Valley, and it's an area where military equipment is stored between uses. So that was the first record. The year after that, they were found at an Army base in Texas. And since then, they've also been found at Fort McPherson in Georgia, which is just south of Atlanta. I'm not sure if that's an Army depot or not, but it's another military installment here. So yeah, that's the prevailing theory is, you know, so as I mentioned, the cockroaches deposit these oophagi, the egg capsules. And when they're first deposited, they can have some secretions, some sticky secretions on them, so they can adhere to surfaces. So if you imagine some military equipment, you know, sitting in the desert or a suburban environment in Western Asia, the cockroaches crawl up inside to harbor. Maybe they deposit some oophagi, and then that equipment moves back to the United States. That seems like the most plausible route for introduction. But there's another way that they may be getting moved around. Have you heard the name Red Runners?
No.
So do you have any friends that raise lizards or other small reptiles?
Is this one of the cockroaches that you can buy at like the pet store?
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay.
So you can buy these online. They call them Red Runners because the nymphs have a red head and thorax, sometimes reddish legs. They move quickly, so there's the Red Runner. They're ideal for feeding terrarium pets because they lack arolia, you know, the structures on the feet that allow cockroaches to climb slick surfaces. This species does not have those, and so it cannot climb up the glass of a terrarium. So you get dump them in a lizard's cage and they run around. And so that's another hypothesis for how Turkestan cockroaches move around is via internet purchase for reptile enthusiasts.
And then people just let them go or they just escape.
Or if you think, let's say you have a reproducing population and you have some oophagi that are deposited in the litter of your cage and then you toss that out, probably not intentional release.
I'm reading on a website for reptile food. Red Runner roaches are also known as the Turkestan roach and are from Central Asia and the Middle East. They're very nutritious. They have a high meat to shell ratio containing 37% protein and 6% fat, making them very similar to a cricket nutritionally. And I think you can buy, what does it say here? One container of 25 nymphs for $6.
There you go. You can start your own infestation.
Your own invasive species brought to your door by United States Postal Service.
Yep.
Wow.
That's the brave new world we live in these days.
I think this is fascinating for me. I am one of those dastardly horticultural entomologists you referred to earlier, and I talk to a lot of urban entomologists. I don't feel like you all get to talk about invasive species as much as we do, even though so many of the insects that you deal with are non-native species. It just doesn't feel like invasive terminology often pops up. Is that part of the programming that you do? Do you use the word a lot, invasive, when you're talking about these, or is it just not as important maybe with this?
There's no trade money associated with these guys. Yeah, I mean, the whole invasive species phenomenon in agriculture and horticulture is based on trade and the money associated with global trade. So, we don't have the same economic importance, at least from the USDA standpoint or, you know, state departments of agriculture. These insects are not threatening a global trade agreement, so they don't get the same kind of billions of dollars thrown at them like you see with like spotted lanternfly or something like that. But yeah, we do use the term invasive. This insect's been here for what, 30 or 40 years now? So it seems established to me. You can buy it online without any kind of, with no restrictions. So no, we don't have the same privileges or restrictions that you might have in agriculture or horticulture with regards to invasive species. So, for instance, we have an invasive termite in Southern California, the Formosan subterranean termite, and it's highly damaging. As you know, this is the most damaging termite species in the world, and our state is not that concerned. I mean, it's the pest control industry's problem.
That's a interesting little side note, I guess, just because, I mean, as you said, like agricultural commodities, when they get threatened, there's money behind that. But I mean, we are talking about people being threatened here, are we not? I mean, we're talking about a cockroach. Is this not a potential health hazard, or is it the cleanest cockroach in the world? Like, what are we dealing with?
In theory, well, it's more than just theory. Cockroaches are considered public health pests. Now, the poster child for public health importance is the German cockroach. And this is a species that lives and breeds indoors. So you're breathing in its cast exuviae and feces and saliva, and that creates allergies, asthma problems. And then, of course, there's the opportunity for mechanical transmission of pathogens. So that's a big deal if the cockroaches are living and breeding, you know, where you're living and eating. But with a peridomestic species like Oriental or Turkestan cockroaches, in theory, the exact same problems can occur, but you're dealing with much, much smaller populations and much less opportunity for contamination of food, for instance. These cockroaches are not great climbers. They're not usually associated with food handling environments. As Jody was saying, you might find them more in the ground floor of buildings, maybe where you have excessive moisture. That's where they're going to survive. So there's not as much opportunity for contamination of food, but in theory, it can happen. There are proteins associated with the cast skins, the feces, and the saliva of these cockroaches, at least Oriental cockroaches, that are known allergens. So, yeah, they are public health pests, but not in the same way as cockroaches that live indoors.
Are those allergens also blodgy, or do they have a different name when they're in?
They have a different name. Yeah, those are the German cockroach ones. Some of these allergens have been identified with Oriental cockroach. I don't think anybody's done any work with Turkestan cockroach, looking at proteins that be considered allergens. I saw a paper from Pakistan showing that Turkestan cockroaches can mechanically transmit salmonella. So the potential is there. But yeah, they're peridomestic species that, you know, if your home is properly climate controlled, you have reduced humidity, you're not likely to have a raging infestation indoors.
And these do not fly.
Well, this is interesting. Okay, so...
Okay.
Turkestan cockroaches have what we call sexual dimorphism. So the male Turkestan cockroach actually looks very different from the female Turkestan cockroach. the male has fully formed wings. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
The female has brachypterous or reduced wings. She couldn't fly even if she tried. She has no wings at all, similar to like an Oriental cockroach. But the male has fully formed wings that extend past its abdomen. I personally have observed male Turkestan cockroaches gliding. I have not observed what I would call flight, like you see with American cockroaches and some other Periplaneta species. So on a warm night, if you pick up a male Turkestan cockroach and throw it in the air, it will glide down. Also, male Turkestan cockroaches during mating season perch on vertical substrates, sometimes 2-3 meters in the air. So when you come up on that cockroach and scare it, it will jump and glide down to its harborage. I don't know if I would call that flying. It's gliding. It's controlled falling, I guess.
Falling with style.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, I mean, I don't know if you're going to share some images with your listeners, but that's one of the most striking things about Turkestan cockroaches is how different the males and females look from one another. And as a result, we have misidentification that is different whether you're looking at a female or a male. So the females often get misidentified as Oriental cockroaches, but the males sometimes get misidentified as American cockroaches because they're kind of a light golden brown. They have those fully formed wings. And if someone's used to only seeing either Oriental or American cockroaches that are that size, they may think the males are American cockroaches.
Kind of has the M on the top a little bit.
Oh, I was going to ask. Let me describe how I would recall certain roaches. And you can say if, because like with American roaches, 1.5 inches long, they're kind of like reddish brown. And then they've got the M or this outline halo type thing on the pronotum.
The McDonald's logo.
Yes, the McDonald's logo. Is that similar to what the Turkestan?
Yeah, I mean, and there's a lot of, I think there's a lot of variation that you see in coloration of a lot of insects. You can have dark individuals. And when I tell people about the Australian cockroach, which is somewhat common here, it has a Batman logo on its pronotum. Yeah, so there is kind of a distal blush on the back of the pronotum of the American cockroach. You will see that sometimes with Turkestan cockroaches, but then also on the lateral edges of the pronotum, there's lighter color.
Doesn't the Australian cockroach have that too?
Yeah, if you look, it looks almost exactly like the Batman.
It does.
Symbol.
Oh wow!
This is my new favorite cockroach.
Yeah.
So when I think of Oriental cockroaches, it's like a dark, like almost it's like black, shiny. They kind of look greasy to me. Uh-huh. And so the male's got like 3/4 length wings, but they don't fly as far as
Oriental cockroach.
Yeah. And then the female doesn't have wings, but has those little stubby nubs. Is there a difference when you're looking at a female Turkestan cockroach and these are in an adult Oriental cockroach? Can you tell the difference? Are they the same size and shape?
They're the same size and shape generally and the same color. So if all you see is one skittering by, you may not be able to make the identification. But if you have a specimen in hand, and you do that all the time, right, Jody? You grab cockroaches with your hand.
If I could see them, I usually just get brought a smashed one in a
bag. Pockets are just full of them. It's crazy.
But yeah, if you had a specimen close enough to view, even dorsally, you don't have to look at it from all angles. But there are two ways that you can distinguish Turkestan from Oriental females. The first way, which is the easiest way, is if you look at the reduced wings, some people call them wing buds. They're not really wing buds. They're reduced wings. On the lateral edge, you know, so on the sides of the body, there's a cream-colored stripe that you'll see on the edge of those wings. And that's not present on the Oriental cockroach. The Oriental cockroach, it's a uniform dark wing. So the problem is that some individuals are dark and you won't see that the lateral cream edge very well. So the tried and true way to do it, which requires some measurement, is to actually look at the space between the wings on the thorax there and measure the width of that space between the wings. If the width of that space is wider than the width of an individual wing, that's an oriental cockroach. So oriental cockroaches have a much wider thorax. The space between the wings is wider than the width of an individual wing. Turkestan cockroaches, the space between the two wings is less than the width of an individual wing. So it's a comparison of wing width compared to the interstitial width, you know, the space between the wings.
I look at a picture of a male Turkestan roach. It actually looks very similar to a wood roach to me, the Virginia wood roach.
Is that Parkoblatta?
Yeah.
We don't have a whole lot of Parkoblatta species here. It may be. I'm not sure what the difference may be there. There may be some lookalikes that you'll have to deal with in other parts of the country.
Yeah, they look very similar to different cockroaches that we have here.
It sounds like a very sneaky cockroach.
The sneaky one?
Yeah, like if it looks like all these other ones, we could have it in all these places and never know it.
And that's probably why we're just now seeing this seeming explosion in the distribution, is I think that there's more knowledge about this species and people are saying, oh yeah, I've had that one for a while. And they just have been misidentifying it as a different species. You know, the interesting thing, I've been reading up a little bit on cockroach systematics. And it's, you know, the genus Periplaneta is polyphyletic. So you look at a cladogram and the trees are multi-branched, and multi-branches fall within Periplaneta. I mention this because just a few months ago, a paper came out looking at the phylogenetics of this clade of blatted cockroaches, and they have synonymized the genus Shelfordella, which has been used for Turkestan cockroaches, with Periplaneta. So as of 2 or 3 months ago, the scientific name for Turkestan cockroaches is actually Periplaneta lateralis. And that's interesting because about a year or two ago, people referred to it as Shelfordella lateralis. And before that, it was considered to be Blatta lateralis, which is the same genus as oriental cockroach. If you look at these cladograms, Blatta orientalis, which is the oriental cockroach, is actually within this paraphyletic group that we call Periplaneta. So time will tell, but the genus Blatta may be synonymized with Periplaneta in the near future as well.
Those scientific names, they're always changing on us.
Yeah. And you know, you look at the morphology and you say, oh, well, these guys are different and one can fly and one can climb slick surfaces. Well, the authors of these papers explain that by just different evolutionary histories evolving in different habitats.
Right.
So the roaches that are very good climbers were found in forests and were climbing trees, and some other cave-dwelling species didn't have as much need to climb, you know, so you have all these different morphologies, which are confusing and lead you down, I guess, a false lead.
Would that be similar to like the ecotypes of head lice and body lice?
I'm not sure. Tell me about that.
Oh, well, just that they're the same species, just different subspecies based on their environment, where they live and how they relate with humans. They have slightly different morphology, but not. The head lice can only lay eggs near the scalp and breed and feed on the scalp, whereas body lice is able to withstand desiccation, being off the host, and so they can lay eggs in the seams of clothing. But if they do all the tests, they're the same species. You can hardly tell them apart.
Yeah. And you know, it may be divergence in action, you know, so you have two populations of a similar species that have different habitats, and over many, many generations they develop different traits that help them adapt to their environment.
Right. So for your fact sheets and your online resources, do you have to change the names then?
Yeah. you're actually the first person I've told this little secret to, because the paper I'm referencing just came out at the end of 2023.
Wow. And you get to put a note in there, like the reason why.
Yeah,
that's pretty neat.
Yeah. And it makes it difficult when you work with a pest control industry, because they don't care about the reason why. They say, you know, why did you change the name? We just learned that other one and now you're changing it. But the common name will remain Turkestan cockroaches.
What are the impacts of having the Turkestan cockroach in place or displacing the Oriental cockroach in these accounts that you're working with? Have you seen troubles and challenges there?
Yeah. The biggest one, I think, is since they breed, you know, they produce more offspring than the Oriental cockroaches, the populations build up to higher levels than pest control operators may have seen with the Oriental cockroach. And with higher population comes higher probability that they're going to end up inside a structure or somewhere else that they don't belong. So they have become more serious pests than the Oriental cockroach was ever considered. And I think that has led to some questioning of the tactics that are used by the pest control industry. So perimeter insecticide sprays are often touted as good strategies for these kinds of outdoor species that may incidentally come in. You know, some people call it perimeter protection. But the problem is that any insect that crosses that barrier of insecticide, yes, it might die, but if it makes its way indoors, it's still dying inside. And so people still don't want to see that dead insect inside. And if you have high pressure, you know, some of these environments that we were doing Turkestan cockroach research, we would set traps, you know, glue traps right next to exterior doors on the exterior of buildings. And we would catch sometimes 20, 30, 40, 50 cockroaches per night. So if all of those cockroaches are walking by the exterior door, a lot of them are going to go in. They're going to go under the door. And so even if you have an effective insecticide barrier, you're not solving the pest problem, which was the people who work or live in that building don't want to see the cockroach. So this has led to, I think, people considering more exclusion tactics. Like, hey, what about a door sweep or a brush, you know, filling up cracks and crevices where they find these cockroaches breeding outside. And then I think people are more interested in baits. And so with German cockroach, which we discussed already, baits have been considered the primary tactic for probably 40 years now, you know, since the 1980s. And it reduces the pesticide exposure to the people living in that environment. And then since we have lots of active ingredients, we can rotate those and it reduces the chance for insecticide resistance to develop. So we're seeing people consider baits for outdoor use for Turkestan cockroaches now. And I think only in very serious pest situations with Oriental cockroach in the past would people have considered these baits. You know, so we have granular as well as gel formulations that are labeled for use outdoors, and they are very, very effective against these cockroaches. So I think we've seen a shift in the standard protocol for outdoor cockroaches, at least here in California.
I talk about baiting a lot, and that's kind of unheard of for outdoor cockroaches. I mean, it's only becoming acceptable when I'm talking ants now, like bait outside. So if you're not baiting on your counter, so they're not coming in on your counter, you know, put that outside. Are the same baits, do the same active ingredients and formulations work for all cockroaches?
There are different formulations for outdoors versus indoors in some cases, so that especially if we're talking gel, so that the gel may do better under drier, desiccating environments, or conversely, really wet environments like inside a water meter box, or, well, you can't apply them to storm drains, but yeah, some kind of very humid environment. And then, of course, granular bait, we don't typically use indoors. So the granular bait is almost universally registered for outdoor use only. But yeah, we have found some gel formulations that do really well outdoors, even in dusty, dry environments.
So when I'm talking to people about baiting and the idea of it, because, you know, people see the containers or and they're always like, oh, yeah, that's a mouse trap. Oh, that's a rat trap. Oh, that's an ant trap or a cockroach trap. And I'm like, no, this is a bait station. Like, that's different. It's not trapping anything. It's feeding.
Yeah.
How do you explain that to people? The idea behind baiting is feeding them something they like that will eventually kill them and their friends.
I think we have pretty good acceptance of baiting, definitely in the pest control industry here in California, and perhaps increasingly in the residential population. You mentioned baiting for ants. So we have lots and lots of environmental reasons for restrictions on outdoor pesticide use in California. The state is very concerned about contamination of surface water, especially in urban areas where you have a lot of impervious surfaces and whatever liquid you apply on a surface is going to wash off into urban creeks, storm drains. So for years, we have been pushing people and industry towards baiting for ants, as you mentioned. They could be liquid, gel, granular formulations. And so I think people are open to that concept with cockroaches as well, especially we've been to plenty of places where there's a regular spray service and there's still a lot of cockroaches because you're spraying the perimeter of the building. The cockroaches don't live right there. You know, they're harboring in a crevice that might be 10 meters away. And so you're not really impacting the population. You still have these huge populations of cockroaches outside and you're spraying regularly. So I think when people see that, they're open to another tactic.
I have an entirely different line of questioning, if that's okay. I don't want to take us away from management. We usually end on management, but
yeah.
I am very curious about, I guess the thing that popped up in my head was this idea that they're in Arkansas, they're in California. I looked at the hardiness zones maps for each area, and they're pretty different. There's some crossover, of course, but I also read this. This is a long windup, and I apologize. It was a San Francisco Chronicle article from 2022, and it was all about Turkestan roaches. They interviewed an entomologist and a pest control professional and a public health person, and it was all about basically it's so hot, and the heat is making them push out, and they're looking for water. They may not do as well in San Francisco because San Francisco is kind of damper, right? It has kind of clouds that roll in. It stays cooler and wetter. Is that correct?
So we do still see oriental cockroaches in the cooler parts of the San Francisco Bay Area. I would say that you don't see a lot of foraging activity in these cockroaches until you get above about 15 degrees Celsius, which is 59, 60 degrees Fahrenheit. So if your nighttime temperatures are below that, you're not likely to see foraging. And in San Francisco, I don't know if you heard the quote from Mark Twain, you know, the coldest winter of my life was the summer in San Francisco.
Yeah.
the temperature is pretty similar throughout the year where you've got about, you know, 60s during the day and 50s at night. That's pretty much all the time in coastal, if you're right there next to the water in California, pretty much all the way down the state, you know, until you get down to LA, San Diego, it's very mild on the coast. And so San Francisco doesn't have warm nights any time of the year. Now, all you got to do is drive 30, 40 minutes inland and it's very warm, you know, so it may be 90s during the day in the summer and, you know, 60s at night. So I think that's why we haven't seen them colonize the city. But if you go down to San Jose, they're everywhere. Oakland, certain parts, you can find them. Definitely the interior parts of California, all of LA, all of San Diego, it's warm enough there for them to forage and find what they need at night.
So I guess what I was kind of leading up to was, are the drier or wetter states going to be more impacted by this? And does it have to do with the success of oriental cockroaches as well? Are they being supported and then being able to fight against this one? Is that part of the equation?
Yeah, we'll have to see. I mean, nobody knows, but I can venture some guesses. I think that if the only other outdoor species present is Oriental cockroach. Turkestan cockroaches will have an advantage when it's drier. You know, the drier it is, the better the Turkestans are going to do in relation to the Oriental cockroach. If it's exactly optimal for both, the Turkestan's still going to win because they're producing more offspring. As you get into the south, and especially the southeast, I'm from Florida, there's lots of species that are outside, including Periplaneta, you know, American cockroach, which is has a larger foraging range. They're bigger. They're more voracious. I can see if the Turkestan cockroach gets there, may not do very well because the niche is already filled by a more aggressive, larger species.
Very cool. I like this cockroach invasion biology. This is interesting stuff to talk about.
Ooh, what about smoky browns?
Yes, smoky browns you see in the south, they're not common at all in California.
I've never seen one.
But yeah, I think Texas, Arkansas, Alabama, Mississippi, smoky brown may be the most important outdoor species. And they also are larger than Turkestans. They may outcompete them down there.
That will be interesting.
It also feels like a lot of this is contingent on climate change, right? I mean, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Local climate as well as any changes that we see there.
So the short version is we don't know.
We don't know.
We don't know what the climate will be. We don't know what to tell you the cockroach situation might be.
Yeah. Now I'm going backwards. But the nymphs, do they look like all the other nymphs when they're little? Can you tell them apart?
Very, very difficult. If you have an Oriental and Turkestan nymph of the same age next to one another, the Oriental nymph is bigger generally and darker. So the Oriental cockroach nymphs are more of a uniform dark brown, although the young ones can be kind of light brown. The Turkestan nymphs typically have red coloration, especially on their head, thorax, and sometimes on their legs. So that's where the Red Runner name comes from in herpetology. But the Oriental cockroach nymphs will not have that red coloration at any stage.
And then I'd like to hear some of your research with the Turkestan cockroach.
So. I guess there's two things. One was establishing the efficacy of the baiting. So here in California, we have a series of laws that we call the Healthy Schools Act, which requires, you know, special notifications and signage if you're going to spray an insecticide. So a lot of pest control operators look for exempt applications, which do not require that notification and posting. And one of the exempt applications is baits within self-contained tamper-proof stations. So we wanted to test a program that did not include any sprays, that included some kind of station or other bait application that, you know, would bypass those requirements, but still be very effective. So we did this at a school district, and then we later expanded it to multiple school districts where there was a biblical population of Turkestan cockroaches. They had a Facebook page, eradicate the cockroaches at so-and-so high school. There were parents going there at night filming videos and showing up at board meetings saying, you guys need to do something. People will go to the football games and put their sweaters and backpacks down in the bleachers, and then they'd have cockroaches crawling on the backpacks when they put them back on. So huge problem. We demonstrated this bait-only program, and it was very effective. We just cratered the population after two rounds of baiting. And the cool thing is that we used some rodent bait stations. So they're triangular. They're made for mice. And you can install them in the corner of hardscape. And we would either bolt them down or adhere them down. And it was a lock and key. You have to use a little plastic key to open them. We would make our applications inside. And we weren't sure if that was going to work. And we would go and do night inspections. And sure enough, you see the cockroaches going in and out of these stations, and you'd open up the station, see the baits all gone. So it was really cool to try that out and have it work so well. There are a number of pest control operators that are using that protocol now. throughout their operations when they're dealing with outdoor cockroaches and maybe even some other settings that we haven't tested in. So that was really cool. The other thing that we saw is the overwintering is by nymphs. So people tend to notice these cockroaches when they're adults and they're mating and they're everywhere and they're big and they're scary. But soon after they mate and deposit their ootheke, the adults start to die. And so over winter, you just have nymphs of varying stages that are overwintering. And if you can find the overwintering habitats, you can actually vacuum them up or use some other physical tactic to reduce the population that you will deal with next year. You know, so since it has such a long lifespan, it's about a year and a half from egg to death, you can actually do some management during the cool season when they're not causing problems.
And that high school changed their mascot to the Fighting Andrew Sutherlands, I presume, right? In your honor?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I made a lot of friends in the staff. You know, people got to know who I was and they learned about the program. And I believe they kept it going after we left. But yeah, it was a serious problem there for a while. And they were getting a lot of bad press and all kinds of videos on social media about how bad it was.
Yeah. So no, that sounds like perfect extension.
That particular project.
I absolutely can imagine that you do. That sounds like a perfect extension project to me. We're kind of running up on the time limit here. We're kind of coming to the end. I was kind of curious, do you have any pluggables that you would like to send people towards? A website or any resources that you think people should check out? They don't have to be limited to Turkestan roaches either.
Yeah, I think the big one is the UCIPM website. I mentioned that it's the most widely accessed pest management source in the world. And when you show up there, you want to make sure that you're going to the right section. So we have a section that's for home, garden, and landscape pests. If you're visiting this site as a resident, that's where you want to go. And there's definitely a long form resource called a Pest Notes about cockroaches that will talk about Turkestan as well as some of the other species that we mentioned during this recording. But you can also learn about all kinds of other things, you know, rats, mice, ground squirrels, aphids, garden pests. So I would say check that out. And there are a series of blog articles that are linked to this website that will go into kind of case-specific information. So yeah, I would say check that out. We also have a YouTube channel. So if you search UCIPM YouTube, you'll find all of our YouTube videos. I've got a very popular video there that teaches people how to use bed bug monitoring devices. It's called How to Use a Bed Bug Detector. Check that out.
That's awesome. We will link to those in our show notes so people can find them more easily after listening to the show. We really appreciate your time, Andrew. This was amazing. I learned so much about this species of cockroach that I've never encountered, and I appreciate your expertise. Jody, why are you laughing?
I don't know. Because I could talk about cockroaches forever. I just want one more question.
Go for it.
Are there any predators that you know of besides Andrew Sutherland?
Well, Jonathan read the nutritional information from the website. So we know that these are very nutritive packets of food. I have not observed predation, but I would think lots of different vertebrate animals. I do know that sometimes we would use jars. You know about the jar trap for cockroaches, especially for Oriental or Turkestan cockroaches that can't climb slippery surfaces. You get a mason jar, you wrap masking tape around the outside, and then on the inside, you put a piece of bread. Some people will soak it in beer. They say it works really well. You know, the cockroaches can climb up, they fall in, but then they can't get out. So we would collect cockroaches like this at the high schools where I was working. Invariably, if we left them out too long, they would be picked clean, knocked over. So I'm thinking maybe raccoons, skunks, foxes. We have a lot of, you know, small vertebrates like that in California. So yeah, I'm not sure, but I've definitely seen spiders eating them. You know, we have a healthy black widow population, and if a nymph gets stuck in a black widow web, it's toast. So yeah, I think the sky's the limit. These are very nutritious animals.
I didn't know if there was like mice and moles or rats or anything like that too?
I would say all of the above.
Nice.
I mean, I'm hearing free range protein bars at this point. Yeah. Is a possibility. California proud.
Yeah. And it, what was it? The shell to liquid ratio or something is quite low. So
yeah,
they're really juicy, I guess.
High meat to shell ratio.
Yeah. High meat to shell ratio.
Yeah. Approaching crab-like levels, perhaps even.
Yeah.
Well, again, we thank you for all your expertise and joining us today on Arthropod. If the folks out there listening want to find us on the web, we're arthro-pod.blogspot.com. That's where you can find the show notes if you want to see any of this Turkestan roach information that we're going to post there. You can find the show on Twitter. We're arthro_podshow. We are also on Spotify and all the different podcatcher apps, where we appreciate ratings and reviews and questions if you've got them. On Spotify in particular, there's a Q&A section. And we'll try to address any questions that you have that you post there. So far, everything has just been very polite comments. So we appreciate that. You can find Jody and I also on the web. I'm at Bugman John on Twitter.
I'm at Jody Bugs Me UNL. Andrew, and do you have any social medias?
You can find me on LinkedIn, but that's professional. That's a professional name.
It is very professional.
It is very professional. That's why I don't go there very often.
So look up Andrew on LinkedIn and become LinkedIn pals. The meme game is strong, I hear, on LinkedIn, though. I hear that there's a lot of funny stuff that gets posted there. So maybe that's what people will find for you there.
Yeah. They say it's the new Facebook.
Who wouldn't want that? Thank you, Andrew. And thank you all for listening. We'll catch you in another couple of weeks on another episode of Arthropod.
It's time for our insect heroes to put away their nets and pheromone traps. Join us next time, same bug time, same bug channel, as the Arthropod gang make the world safe from poor insect podcasts. Until then,
keep on bugging.